An attack on Iran's nuclear assets puts it and Israel on a course that could take them to a dangerous tipping point.
I think Israel and Iran are in an escalation course that might get out of hand to places where both sides actually do not want it to be.
Also today, the people who resettle refugees in the U.S. are frustrated with the Biden administration. They want to know when caps will be lifted.
I'm hopeful there'll be some transparency and we'll find out soon.
I'm Marco Werman, and U.S. foreign policy loses one of its most vocal critics.
I refer to him as kind of a shadowy, sophisticated Forrest Gump, because almost every major event from the early 60s forward, he was there for.
We remember Ramsey Clark. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Iran is vowing revenge against Israel, this in response to an explosion at an Iranian nuclear enrichment site over the weekend. The attack at the Natanz site occurred just hours before U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin touched down in Israel on a diplomatic mission. Austin said the U.S. will continue to try to engage with Iran over its nuclear program. He also made clear where Washington stands.
Our commitment to Israel is enduring and it is ironclad.
Meanwhile, talks between Tehran and European diplomats continue in Vienna. They're trying to reinvigorate the Iran nuclear deal by bringing the White House back into the fold. The World's Ariel Osiran reports.
Iran's nuclear program hit a new high and a new low this weekend. On Saturday, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani celebrated the country's 15th annual National Nuclear Day by ordering the activation of new centrifuges on live TV.
عملیات گازدهی به ماشین‌های نسل جدید سنتریفیوژ در مجتمع.
The festivities even included a music video featuring singing scientists dressed in white lab coats. Standing beside a set of centrifuges, some of them held photos of colleagues who were assassinated in recent years. By Sunday, though, the celebration was over.
And this breaking news, CNN is learning more about an incident which caused a blackout at an Iranian nuclear facility. According to Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, the incident was a, quote, terrorist action.
A mysterious explosion caused a massive power failure at the Natanz facility, which is considered the centerpiece of Iran's enrichment program.
It looks as if there is no possibility now in Natanz to enrich uranium.
Seema Shain is a former head of research at the Mossad, Israel's national intelligence agency. She now leads the Iran program at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv.
If it is correct, it's a huge, huge damage.
Israel is suspected of carrying out the attack, which it will neither confirm nor deny. The country wants to roll back advancements Iran made since the U.S. abandoned the 2015 nuclear deal. This is just the latest incident that further heightens tensions between the two countries. In recent years, they've been engaged in a shadow conflict across the Middle East. Iran's responses to Israeli strikes, though, have been limited so far, but those attacks are becoming more frequent. From every few months, now they're every few days. And with targets getting more strategic and a veil of secrecy pretty much gone, things could quickly change.
I think Israel and Iran are in the last weeks on escalation course toward a collision that might get out of hand and deteriorate to places where both sides actually do not want it to be.
This recent escalation could further complicate the indirect talks taking place between the U.S. and Iran, both trying to negotiate a nuclear deal. Hamid Mousavi, a professor of political science at the University of Tehran, says the timing of the attack is probably not a coincidence.
I think the Israelis are deliberately trying to derail talks between Iran and the United States, and they've been doing this for over a decade now.
And he says Washington is well aware of this.
I think the Biden administration views the current escalation with apprehension, but not surprise.
Matthew Levitt is a senior fellow and director of the Reinhardt Program on Counterterrorism and Intelligence at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Levitt says that Iran is trying to increase its leverage in the current talks by continuing to escalate its nuclear activities while still engaging in other illicit activities as well. But it still wants a seat at the table.
I think both parties have a real interest in seeing some type of success at these talks, which doesn't mean they will succeed. Iran in particular is in a very difficult spot financially. It cannot simply walk away from these talks. So I don't think that these recent events are going to, you know, implode the talks, but I do think it will make them a little more testy.
In the meantime, Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, vowed today that his country would retaliate against Israel. But he added, quote, "We won't allow any sabotage to affect nuclear talks." For the world, I'm Ariel Osoran.
More vaccines are getting into people's arms, but what does this mean in terms of the planet catching up to the spread of the coronavirus? The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for the show and joins me. What is kind of the pulse of this pandemic globally right now, Alana? Where are we at with infections?
Well, the big picture, Marco, is that the world is actually experiencing a steady increase in infections. Leaders at the WHO again sounded the alarm today because it's been 7 straight weeks of rising infections, actually. It's some of the highest surges yet in the pandemic, and it's been 4 weeks straight of a rise in deaths.
What areas are most impacted? Do we have a sense of that?
So I talked with Ali Mokhtad about this. He's with the Institute for Health Metrics at the University of Washington, and he's been modeling this pandemic since the start. He says what's going on in 5 regions really stands out. So first,
there is an increase in Brazil that's now started to come down.
So Brazil is the big one. Neighboring countries like Argentina and Chile are now starting to experience rises too. And then here are the other hotspots.
There is a big rise which is still going on in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, that part. There is an increase in Europe and the Middle East following what Europe has been seeing. There is a rise in cases in the Philippines, and there is a rise in South Africa and parts of African country that's now started to come down.
So the fact that infections are increasing globally, even in parts of the U.S., we don't want to forget that, that really worries him.
I mean, it sounds like overall the world is just not close to controlling this virus. Do scientists have a handle on why cases continue to rise even with vaccines? I mean, is it now all about the variants?
Mokhtad points to the variants, and lots of scientists do. Variants like B.1.1.7 have become dominant in Europe, and this has been found to be more transmissible. But there's another strong message I'm hearing from a lot of scientists like Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at Georgetown and, as of this month, the University of Saskatchewan, which is that these rises are not just from variants. Like, they can't break through masking and distancing and other really important prevention tools.
There's an analogy I like that you can draw a smiley face on a basketball, but it doesn't mean it can go through walls. And that's really how people should think about these mutations. Just because it's more transmissible doesn't mean that the virus is going to be hunting you down in your home.
And so what she means from that is prevention is just still super important. Take away the virus's opportunity to replicate, and it won't have the chance to mutate and form new variants.
So prevention, yes, of course, but vaccines are still really important to address this as well, yeah?
Yes, super important. Places that are ahead on vaccinations are seeing declines in serious hospitalizations from coronavirus. But again, the global landscape is just so imbalanced. More than 700 million vaccines have been administered globally, and just 0.2% have gone to low-income countries. Today, that's why leaders from across Africa, for example, are having a high-profile meeting to discuss how to improve local manufacturing and regional capacity to improve vaccine capabilities. So places aren't just waiting for countries like the U.S. and parts of Europe to share.
So, Ilana, with the U.K. opening up today and lots of people I hear getting haircuts and going to pubs, are there any lessons that we can learn from past surges?
So this is something that Ali Mokhtad at the University of Washington thinks about a lot. And he has observed a pattern from past surges.
So we've seen this roller coaster. When cases go up, people put their best behavior. And that has been the challenge, is Americans and everybody in the world, they react rather than preempt it.
And what he means is that leaders and people relax and let their guards down, often too soon. And this gets really personal for him. He's from Lebanon and Yemen. He's lost family members there to COVID-19. Others have lost businesses. And he understands people can't afford to stay home. They need to survive. But he worries that when places relax too quickly, the virus bounces back. And so he just feels that more caution is needed.
We're still in a fragile situation. There is a delicate balance between cases and new variants, and we could see a surge. So we're swimming upstream, right, in the months to come.
Yeah, and swimming upstream means we got to continue to be careful. The World's Alana Gordon, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
When the pandemic hit, a lot of undocumented workers were left in a tough position. They didn't have access to government assistance like stimulus checks. But now the state of New York is stepping up. Albany has set aside more than $2 billion for undocumented workers who lost employment. Here's the World's Daisy Contreras.
Pedro Peña spent 3 days on a hunger strike in March. We all lifted our voices so state lawmakers could see we were there, he says. Peña lives in Westchester County, just near New York City. And like thousands of undocumented workers last year, he lost his job. He did construction, and he didn't qualify for unemployment benefits or federal stimulus checks. But he still had kids to feed and bills to pay.
Y entonces empezamos a organizarnos para poder exigir y pedirle un fondo.
Workers started going on hunger strikes, caravans, and vigils all across the state, he says. They called themselves trabajadores excluidos, or excluded workers, and they wanted state lawmakers to help. His hunger strike, Peña says, paid off. Last week, after a contentious fight, state lawmakers approved about $15,000 in one-time payments for undocumented immigrants who lost their jobs last year. It's close to what they would have received if they'd been eligible for unemployment insurance. Workers celebrated. One rally had mariachis. Workers' visibility was key in this win, says Nadia Marin Molina. She's with the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, a nonprofit that joined more than 200 other workers' groups in this movement.
And what really had an impact was that the legislators and the public could see that this was an issue not just about money, but about workers' dignity and humanity.
Marin Molina says workers also made it clear they weren't asking for charity. Undocumented workers do pay taxes, state and local, but they don't often receive the benefits of that.
That is the injustice that they were fighting, and that's the injustice that exists across the country still.
New York isn't the first state to offer economic relief to undocumented immigrants, but it is the biggest effort by far. Last year, California offered a one-time payment of $500 per undocumented worker. Cities like Chicago also offered something similar. Victor Naro is a labor studies professor at UCLA. He says New York will create more pressure on other states to do more. Lawmakers in California should be able to expand the coverage and go even further than New York, he says.
This is not a bipartisan issue at all, I see it. This is an issue of giving this population group of workers what they're entitled to. And this is a chance now to finally right that wrong.
Some critics, especially New York lawmakers who voted against the measure, wanted more proof of lost work, like W-2s, but many undocumented workers don't have those. Others say they worry the funds will be misused and not spent on food or bills. But workers like Benjamin Flores disagree. He may qualify for the cash payment. He lost his job ironing clothes at a garment warehouse in Manhattan.
Pues, pagar lo que yo debo. Me drogué mucho y demasiado, pues.
Flores says he'll use that money to pay his debts. He borrowed money from friends all year. He went to community pantries for food. Right now, he's behind on rent, and his kids need new clothes. Advocates say all of those purchases he'll make will benefit the economy. Pedro Peña, who took part in the workers' hunger strike, says there's a lot left to do to make sure the money is given out soon. The state is still figuring out how to do that. He says once workers start receiving their checks and no one is left out, then he'll celebrate. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. It's been 10 years since the uprising began in Syria. In that time, the numbers have been staggering. More than 500,000 people have been killed in the conflict. Many millions displaced. Also, tens of thousands of Syrians have been imprisoned for opposing the regime, many taken from their homes and never heard from again. Wafa Mustafa is a Syrian journalist and activist whose father, Ali, was taken from his home in 2013. Wafa fled the country with her family soon after that and has been advocating for her father's release ever since. My colleague Carol Hills caught up with her in Berlin.
Wafa, can you tell us the last time you saw your father?
Unfortunately, the last time I saw my dad was a few days prior to his enforced disappearance. And the last time we heard from him was actually on the day of his disappearance, and that was on the 2nd of July 2013. And that makes 2,836 days, unfortunately. And that was when my mom was traveling to visit him in our family house in Damascus. And he was home alone back then. And my mom called him 15 minutes before she arrived. And he was very excited. They didn't meet actually back then for a couple of months because of the his political situation. So he was very excited. She was very excited. And we and me and my sisters were like, you know, making fun of them and saying that, well, now they will meet and they're having this like new honeymoon and everything. And unfortunately, it didn't happen. My mom called my dad and said that, hey, I'm on my way. I'll be there in 15. I need you to come downstairs to help me because I brought like many things, food and clothes and a lot of stuff. And he told her, I'm waiting for you. Everything is perfect. And I cleaned the house and I'll just let me know when you're here. And 15 minutes later, she called and he never responded. And the only information we learned is through the neighbor who told my mom that a group of armed men attacked our place and that she heard noises. And she believes that they were beating him and they were destroying furniture or whatever. And that in a while, they went downstairs with my dad and another person who was actually who turned out to be my dad's best friend. And his family has been told years ago that he got killed under torture in a detention center in Damascus. But we never heard from my dad.
Why do you believe the Syrian regime had him disappeared?
Well, I mean, and it's very unfortunate, but my dad is far from an isolated case in Syria. You know, I mean, detention and enforced disappearance did not start in Syria after the revolution. It has been there in Syria's history since Assad's the father has come to power. So this is not new for us. My dad was even arrested before the revolution, you know, so prison has always been there. My dad has been very political. He had his he expressed his political stance always, even before the revolution. And that obviously was not fine with the regime. And for that reason, he's been detained even before the revolution. And once at the beginning of the revolution, at that time, we knew that where he was for what he was charged with. But unfortunately, the second time was completely different. We learned nothing about him.
How have you been advocating for your father's release and the release of other political prisoners?
To be honest, that was a completely new reality for me and for all of us. I mean, yes, we went to the streets 10 years ago demanding freedom, justice, and a state of law. And yes, we knew the regime was brutal. But to be honest, I mean, this daily life that I have and millions of Syrians have is something I could never imagine. You know, I mean, I'm trying everything I can. Like, I'm trying to advocate on a political level. I addressed the UN Security Council last July. I've talked at the UN General Assembly. I've reached out to politicians, but I'm also regularly I'm trying to be part and organize protests to reach out to the public. And let them know about the nature of detention in Syria and let and to ask them to actually help because they can do something. I've been on daily basis trying to write on social media about my dad and about Syria's disappeared just to actually not keep my dad's memory, but rather his existence. You know, I mean, this is I even do this for myself because I believe that he is still alive, and I want to keep my faith and my hope that he's alive and he will be back. And for that reason, I decided that, okay, then till he's back, I'll just introduce him to the whole world.
You've spent years advocating for your father's release. How difficult is it to work on a cause like this over such a long time?
You cannot imagine what it feels like to wake up every day and realize that my dad is still somewhere between life and death, and that there's nothing I can do about it, and that everything I'm trying to do is just not working. And this is something you do not just forget about, you know? It's not that I will wake up one day and say, oh, okay, my dad is actually forcibly disappeared and I'm helpless and there's nothing I can do, so I'll just accept this reality. I can never accept this reality and I can never tolerate what happened. And I made this decision that I'll just dedicate my life to knowing the truth of my dad's fate. And unfortunately, it is the reality of millions of people. But I will do my best to change it.
How can the international community pressure the Assad regime into releasing more political prisoners?
For years now, we've been only hearing words and talks, but the international community has failed us as Syrians and as families of detainees over and over. I mean, the UN Security Council can and must do something to change the situation in Syria. And I believe that any solution and any justice for Syria must start with the release of all detainees, the end of ongoing detention in Syria today, and the prosecution of all war criminals and all those who committed crimes against humanity in Syria, including Assad himself.
That was Syrian journalist and activist Wafa Mustafa speaking with my colleague, Carol Hills. The world isn't just radio. Here's another way to connect. Start your morning with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. You don't have to go digging for it. Our team here at The World will email it to you so you can start the day informed. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. You're listening to The World. Pandemic lockdowns are easing in the UK. Hair salons are packed today with Brits getting long overdue haircuts.
We've had a lot of funny haircuts coming in today where they've all tried to cut their hair themselves. We've taken some before and after photographs as well.
Step one, fix some bad DIY grooming. Then you can get a haircut. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. We've got a couple of elections this weekend to give you the latest on. Voters in Ecuador have elected a conservative businessman as their new president. Several hundred people cheered last night as Guillermo Lasso prepared to give his victory speech. Meanwhile, in neighboring Peru, it was not immediately clear which two candidates would advance in that country's second round of voting for president. For more on both these elections, I've got The World's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, on the line. Let's touch on the Ecuadorian election first, Jorge. Who is the man who was elected? Guillermo Lasso.
He is a former CEO of a prominent bank in Guayaquil, which is the largest city in Ecuador. He is a former economy minister as well. And this was his third time running for president. Here's how he started off his victory speech last night.
Quiero iniciar esta noche agradeciendo en primer lugar a Dios.
Marco, you started off dedicating a few moments to give thanks to God for blessings upon him and blessings upon the people of Ecuador. Guillermo Lasso happens to be a member of the conservative Catholic organization Opus Dei, though it's unclear how that will figure into his governing. And he, of course, like leaders everywhere, is facing the health and the economic catastrophe that the coronavirus pandemic has brought upon Ecuador. But as with politics everywhere, we'll just have to wait and see how he does wind up governing.
So Lasso, this former banker, he defeated left-leaning Andres Arauz. Arauz is a former cabinet minister of ex-president Rafael Correa. Correa, president for 10 years until just recently when he got caught up in corruption. How much of this race was really about Rafael Correa?
Well, there were clear connections between the campaign of Andres Arauz and Rafael Correa. Arauz is a young politician. He's 36 years old. Many people saw that Correa was his main mentor. And in fact, Arauz himself didn't give a speech at his closing campaign rally until after they played a recording from Rafael Correa. Correa is living in Belgium because he's running from, as you pointed out, a conviction of corruption. But even though he's living outside of the country, he continues to be a large figure in the country's politics. I spoke about this with Jimena Sosa, who is a political historian in the capital of Quito.
I think some people wanted a change. I do believe that these cycles in politics go, you know, eventually so people were tired of the same politics and wanted to give the chance to the other ideologies like conservative right people.
In addition, Jorge, I gather there's another group of voices who have taken a platform in Ecuador right now, indigenous voters. Do we know how they voted yesterday?
That's right, Marco. Indigenous voters make up a large proportion of the electorate in Ecuador, and there was an indigenous candidate in the first round of voting for president. His name was Jacu Perez, and he ran mostly on a platform that was pro-environment, water rights, land rights. But even though it's not entirely clear how Jacu Perez's supporters voted, Guillermo Lasso did perform very well in the highlands of Ecuador and in Ecuador's Amazon region, which are both regions that have large indigenous populations. So the only thing that we know for sure is that indigenous movements will continue to be a strong presence in Ecuador's politics.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that evolves under Lasso. So just next door to Ecuador and Peru, another election. There were presidential elections this weekend, except this was a first round of voting, and we'll go to a runoff. How is that race looking right now?
That's right. Peru's politics, of course, are very different from Ecuador's, but it's also a very complicated situation. There were 18 candidates who were running in this first round of voting for president. The front runner, according to the preliminary official results, is a former union leader and elementary school teacher named Pedro Castillo. And hopefully by tomorrow, we'll have more clarity on who will be the top two candidates, and I'll be able to update you on that. Either way, the presidential runoff for Peru will be in early June.
The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia speaking with us about this weekend's national elections in Peru and Ecuador. Jorge, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
There is a lot of focus on migrants arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. There is also another group of people trying to enter the U.S., refugees, people fleeing danger from abroad who apply for resettlement in the U.S. All of this is done in coordination with the U.N. Far fewer have been resettled here in recent years. President Trump drastically cut the number of refugees allowed into the U.S. Biden promised to restore the program immediately, but he hasn't. The World's Monica Campbell reports on what this means for refugee families.
I first talked to Kaijian Etienne while he was on the road.
Yeah, I'm driving, but still we can't talk.
He's hauling auto parts to Flint, Michigan, across state lines in a big white freight truck.
Today, 450.
450 miles before heading home to Columbus, Ohio. The first place Etienne has settled down in, well, a long time. Etienne is 28, and much of his life has been on the move. He was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
But I left Congo when I was 3 years old.
When he was three, when his family fled civil war. After many years in a refugee camp in Rwanda, Etienne was allowed into the U.S. about 7 years ago. His brother eventually came too.
My mom and the rest of the family were supposed to come.
His mom and siblings had been approved to enter the U.S., but Donald Trump became president and decided to take in far fewer refugees. He also banned many applicants from Muslim and African countries. So Etienne's mom has waited from a crowded refugee camp in Rwanda, like thousands of people worldwide. President Joe Biden gave Etienne's family hope in February.
I'm approving an executive order to begin the hard work of restoring our refugee admissions program to help meet the unprecedented global need.
Biden's campaign promise was to admit 125,000 refugees during his first year in office. Things look so certain that more than 700 refugee flights were booked to the U.S. recently. But now everything's on hold because Biden hasn't yet signed the document that makes the changes official. So those flights have been canceled. Trump's limits remain in place, and U.S. officials have yet to explain why. That's frustrating families waiting for loved ones and people who work to welcome new refugees to the U.S.
What's happening?
If it is a political consideration, the important thing to keep in mind is real people who have already been suffering for so long are going to continue to suffer.
Angie Plummer runs Community Refugee and Immigration Services, a nonprofit in Columbus, Ohio. The group helps new refugees settle in the U.S. Plummer's colleagues were busy getting jobs lined up and apartments ready and furnished for newcomers who they thought would be here by now. She believes the Biden administration wants to allow in more refugees.
And so I have no doubt that they want to support the program. I just don't know what's happened, if this is a political calculation because of the border, but I'm hopeful there'll be some transparency and we'll find out soon.
The State Department didn't grant me an interview, but a spokesperson stressed that the government is committed to rebuilding the refugee program. U.S. officials have also denied that the delay has anything to do with the increasing number of migrants arriving at the U.S.-Mexico border. As for Kajian Etienne, the truck driver, his mom in Rwanda feels stranded. Etienne includes me in one of his regular calls home. His mom, Makuba Wajana Kandenzi, says she hoped to be in the U.S. with her sons by now. Etienne sent me a photo of his mom. She's 58, smiling, wearing a long red and yellow dress. She lives with thousands of other Congolese in the refugee camp in small brick homes. Etienne wires cash to her and his siblings for food, clothing, the basics. And while we talk, we hear a group of kids walk by her window. She says many families at the camp are expecting to go to the U.S. soon. She wants to deliver a message to President Biden. Etienne translates for her.
First of all, to thank him, the fact that he's willing to bring people in to change their lives and, you know, to wish him a good life.
The call is hung up due to insufficient balance.
The call then ends abruptly.
The phone just went off because of the money.
$10 gets him 35 minutes on a prepaid call to his mom's old flip phone. He'll keep paying for those calls until they're all reunited in the U.S. at some point, he hopes. He's written to State Department officials for updates and answers, but no word yet. So he and thousands of others like him wait. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
With pandemic lockdowns now easing in Britain, today seems to be a red-letter day for many there. Pubs, hair salons, and gyms across Britain are all opening up for the first time in months today. Pubs are packed. We're hearing the same for salons. Anne Duggan is a hairdresser who says it's been nonstop at her shop in Nottingham, England, all day. How has the day been going, Anne? What's it looking like at your salon right now?
It's been absolutely crazy from 7:30 this morning, and we're working up till about 7:00 tonight. And everyone is just so happy to see us back and open.
I've heard unofficial news that it's basically impossible to get a haircut booking today. When did you fill your last opening for the 12th?
So I diverted my shop phone to my mobile, and it's just not stopped ringing for 3 or 4 weeks when I've been off, and it's been a nightmare, to be honest. I've been driving along in the car and it never stops ringing because people are so desperate. And we've had a lot of funny haircuts coming in today where they've all tried to cut their hair themselves. So we've taken some before and after photographs as well.
Oh, my. So has your job today been for a lot of clients basically to fix the mistakes and then get to business and do what you're supposed to do?
Yeah, that's right. We've had to fix a lot of mistakes. Some of the mums have had a go at the kids' hairs, and then some of the wives and the grandmas and all sorts have had the haircuts. Even some customers came in joking with a wig on, pretending that the hair had grown really, really long.
But you said the clients are pretty happy and pretty excited to get a haircut since, what's it been, since January?
Oh, so excited. Everybody's so happy, and the sun was shining this morning. It's put everybody in a great mood. And all of us, it's like Christmas Day for us. We're just like, oh, so excited to get back to work.
Are folks keeping Prime Minister Boris Johnson's caution in mind as they get their haircuts? Do you feel they're taking things seriously still?
Yes, I think so. That they understand now. We never used to take bookings because we are a barbershop. And now we've had to get used to this. It's new for us all. And I think a lot of, well, I say 80 to 90% of customers know they have to book now and they can't just walk in. So they've been really good staying outside, sanitizing before they come in. You know, and obviously we have to clean all the chairs before they sit down and basically social distance in between everybody.
So, I mean, aside from those little inconveniences, how does it feel to be back in business after being shut down for so long?
Oh, absolutely great. You know, it was a long time off. I think we've only done about 2 months work in about a year. We've been locked down 3 times now. We just hope it doesn't happen again.
So, Anne, I know you're busy, but let me just ask you this. Any chance you're going for a pint after work today to celebrate? Or are you taking the social distancing rules pretty seriously still?
It's too cold. I don't want to be sitting outside a pub, to be honest. I'd rather sit home with a glass of wine and put my feet up. And that'll be it till tomorrow. And then the same thing will happen all over again for probably the next couple of weeks.
Anne Duggan is a hairdresser in Nottingham, England, has been busy cutting hair all day as England slowly reopens. Anne, thank you very much for joining us. Good luck with the rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
On Friday, the U.S. lost one of its most pointed critics of American foreign policy. Ramsey Clark may be best known for defending Saddam Hussein and serving as Attorney General under President Lyndon Johnson. Ramsey Clark was 93. The world's Roopa Shenoy has this remembrance.
As the nation's chief law enforcement official in the late 1960s, Ramsey Clark held many positions that were deeply unpopular.
But I think he's one of the most overlooked historical figures that we've ever had.
Lonnie Brown is a law professor at the University of Georgia who wrote a book about Clark. Clark led efforts to desegregate schools, preserve voting rights, stop use of the death penalty, curb mass incarceration, and combat police brutality.
I refer to him as kind of a shadowy, sophisticated Forrest Gump because almost every major event from the early 60s forward, he was there for.
The son of a U.S. Supreme Court justice, Clark dropped out of high school and at 17 joined the Marines, becoming a courier during World War II. In 1965, President Johnson tasked Clark, then Assistant Attorney General, with investigating the Watts riots in Los Angeles. Clark later remembered that moment for the LBJ Library.
He sent me out there to see what happened and what we could do about it. I mean, he was just profoundly concerned about the riots.
I believe that experience really opened Ramsey Clark's eyes in a way that certainly not many white people have ever had their eyes opened.
Clark's record during that time is mixed. Brown says Clark could never fully explain why he prosecuted some prominent anti-war activists. Still, Clark refused to send troops to corral anti-war protesters at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And Clark drew President Johnson's ire by refusing to prosecute Stokely Carmichael.
Being on the inside, I think he became somewhat suspicious. And so when he saw individuals demonized by our government in other places, he was more apt to question that.
Clark particularly questioned the war in Vietnam.
I'm the only attorney general since there was a National Security Council that wasn't on the National Security Council because the president didn't want fist fights in there.
This was Clark giving a talk in 2003.
I had a choice, and I think it's the choice. You follow the policy once it's made, and you enforce the law once it's stated, or you resign.
He didn't resign because of what he wanted to help accomplish with civil rights, but after leaving office, Clark charted a fiery path as an anti-war activist. He was accused of being a traitor for visiting Hanoi to document U.S. actions there. He was in Iran during the Iranian Revolution and visited the Zapatistas in Mexico. He spoke out against both President George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush's actions in Iraq.
The U.S. foreign policy, let's just take the last 100 and few years, has been an absolute human tragedy.
This is Clark speaking in 2001 to the Minnesota Alliance of Peacemakers.
If you really love your country, when you see that it's wrong on something of fundamental importance, you have to speak out. Anything else is the most unpatriotic act you can commit and a form of cowardice.
Yet Clark surprised many and was ridiculed for representing men accused of war crimes, from a Nazi prison camp guard to Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. In 2005, he represented Saddam Hussein.
This trial can either divide or heal. And unless it is seen as absolutely fair and is absolutely fair in fact,
It will irreconcilably divide the people of Iraq.
Still, Clark was highly respected in the international community, traveling to places like Syria, Sudan, and Yugoslavia to report the impact of U.S. sanctions. Sarah Flounders accompanied him as co-director of the International Action Center, which Clark founded.
There were so many times that Ramsey Clark took huge personal risks that certainly could have ended his life.
Flounders says Clark believed that if people in the U.S. only knew what their government's actions were doing abroad, they would fight for change. In 2008, the United Nations awarded Clark its prize in the field of human rights.
He had a voice all around the world and was recognized for his contributions of being willing to speak out when everyone else was silent.
In recent years, Flounders says Clark watched movements like Black Lives Matter with pride and optimism, knowing that while he was once just one lone, ostracized voice, now there are many willing to take unpopular positions just because they think it's right. For the world, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
60 years ago today, the Earth sent its first human into outer space, Russia's Yuri Gagarin. On this day in 1961, Gagarin's space capsule completed one orbit around Earth and returned home, marking a major milestone in the space race. As he takes off, you can hear Gagarin's muffled yet iconic «Поехали», which means «let's go» in Russian. Stephen Walker has just published a book about Yuri Gagarin called Beyond, the astonishing story of the first human to leave our planet and journey into space. Stephen, tell us a little more about Yuri Gagarin. Like, before he became known as the first man in space, who was he?
Well, it's a really interesting question. He was actually brought up in a little village just to the west of Moscow. And in 1941, the Nazis invade Russia and they swallow Gagarin's village. And something very seminal happens to Gagarin, which I think determines, in some respects, the course of his life. At the age of 7, he is horrified to see that his little brother, Boris, age 5, is being hanged from a tree, an apple tree, by an SS officer. And he tries to cut his brother down from this branch, but he's very small. He can't do it. So he races back, yells for his mother, Anna, who comes racing out, rushes across and cuts down little Boris, age 5, from this tree just in time. And that experience seared Gagarin for life. It gave him a kind of an inner toughness, an inner resilience, which is why he was able to sit effectively on top of the world's biggest nuclear missile, waiting to be blasted into space.
Right. And as we know, the Americans were stunned when the space capsule orbited the Earth. So I casually told the story of this day in 1961 earlier. Basically, the rocket launched, Gagarin went up, did an orbit, and then came back down alive. But that doesn't quite capture the intense drama of the day, does it?
Not at all. This rocket, it's called an R7, is unbelievably dangerous. The chances of Yuri Gagarin getting back alive were less than 50-50. Almost everything you can think of goes wrong. No one knows what happens to a human being in space. And then, of course, the rocket itself is so dangerous because many of them are blown up. The Russians were desperate to get ahead of America, which means they took risks. So it's an incredibly dramatic tale of this 106 minutes that sort of changed the world.
What was the mission of the Soviet rocket, and what did Gagarin himself think at the time about it?
Well, the mission was basically to see if a human being could survive in space and fly in orbit around the Earth. And there is this secret briefing given by Yuri Gagarin the day after his flight. And he tells the story of what happened 11 minutes after launch. Gagarin separated from the rest of his rocket and he started very gently to spin. And then he turned to the little porthole on his right and he saw the Earth. He had escaped the biosphere.
Incredible perspective. How was Gagarin received once he touched down some 90 minutes later?
Well, he actually landed hundreds of kilometers off course. So he ejects from this capsule at about 20,000 feet and the capsule lands separately and Gagarin, by parachute, lands in a potato field. And there's no one there except an old lady and her granddaughter who are picking potatoes. So he goes up to them and they run away. They're absolutely terrified. They see this guy in an orange spacesuit. He manages to convince them he's a comrade, he's Soviet, he's safe. And he says, I need to get to a phone. Have you got any way of my getting to a phone? So they offer him the use of a horse. This is a guy who's been around the world at 18,000 miles an hour.
Incredible.
And they're talking about putting him on a horse to get to a telephone. It's just crazy. Just before the horse arrives, some tractor drivers turn up, very curious. They've heard about him on the radio, on the kind of state radio, because it's now being broadcast. And then within minutes, this jeep arrives with soldiers, and they all start taking photographs. And there is a photograph of him, which is in my book, and it's just wonderful. He's just been around the whole planet, and he's landed in this potato field, and there's this photograph. It's quite extraordinary.
I mean, it speaks of the high ambition and also the low reality of the Soviet Union during the Cold War. The USSR, as you said, Stephen, was determined to beat the US in getting a human into space. What was the reaction in the West when Yuri Gagarin went up and came home, and specifically in the United States?
Absolute shock. I mean, there is a press conference which President Kennedy, remember, new in the job, gave that afternoon. And he looks completely and utterly shell-shocked. He says, he extends his congratulations to Khrushchev, who was the premier of the USSR at the time, and also to the man who was involved. He can't even say his name. But it is a real bad moment for him and for the American space program.
They secured these large boosters, which have led to their being first in Sputnik and led to their first putting their man in space. We are, I hope, going to be able to carry out our efforts with due regard to the problem of the life of the man involved this year. But we are behind.
And, you're looking at somebody who is on the back foot. And we know this because 2 days later, Gagarin was celebrated in a basically parade that was millions of people, the biggest party, really, in Moscow's history.
Only a little over 3 months ago, he was unknown. Now he is guaranteed a tremendous welcome anywhere in the world.
And at the very time that Gagarin was being celebrated and having the Hero of the Soviet Union Gold Star Medal pinned to his chest, we know that Kennedy was in the cabinet room at the White House with his advisors, and Kennedy is tapping his teeth with his pencil, which is always a sign of nervousness with him. And he says, what can we do? What can we do to catch up? How do we leapfrog them? And he comes up with this wonderful line. He says, even if the janitor in the White House has an answer, I want to hear that answer. And this is when the moon idea really starts to take hold. And what I hope I have managed to do is to put readers right in the center, in the epicenter of events, with a little fly on the wall that gives us an often very jaundiced view, but really fascinating inside story of what was really happening and how different that was from the presentation to the world of what was happening.
Writer Stephen Walker speaking with us on the 60th anniversary of man's first spaceflight. Walker's new book about Yuri Gagarin is called Beyond, the astonishing story of the first human to leave our planet and journey into space. Great to have you with us today, Stephen. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much for having me. Appreciate that.
Amazing. How do you say the right stuff in Russian? An incredible story there. That is our show today, but we're always online at theworld.org. We come to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong, till tomorrow.